This audio is brought to you by Muslim Central. Please consider donating to help cover our running costs and future projects by visiting www.muslimcentral.com/donate.
Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Allahumma salli wa sallim wa barik ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa ala alihi wa sahbihi ajma'in wa ba'd. This may not be the best place under the speaker, eh? I may have to move a little bit forward because the speaker, I think, is right there. I'll move over here. Is that okay? If you guys go back a little bit. Okay. So this, I started doing these seven-episode series, I think maybe four or five years ago within Ramadan. I always choose the worst time to do it within the last 10 nights, only because it's the time that I have off. That's when I end up doing it. Every year I choose a topic and I kind of go through an explanation of the topic in some degree of detail or lack of detail, depending on the topic. And this, and what I'm going to talk about this year is something I was hoping to talk about actually a few years ago, and every year I just kind of postponed it and put it off and did something different. Because talking about it is a little bit, it can be sometimes a little bit, I don't say boring, but and dry. Talking about issues of Iman, talking about facing the reality of disbelief in the modern context. Scholars of Islam historically did this very, very well within the context of their time, meaning the books of I'tiqad that we have are very well tuned to people who are living in a certain era, very well. I don't find that to be the case for people who are living maybe in the last 100 years, where a lot of change has occurred in terms of how we view faith in general, or religion, or iman. And a lot of that comes from the amazing scientific advancements that we've made, and then the lack of kind of understanding the difference between certain disciplines of thought. And I feel as Muslims, it's important that we have a very good grasp on that, and that you have the tools that will allow you to deal with some of these arguments that you may face, whether high school level, university, or even beyond that. And what I'm going to do today is I'm going to give you a bit of an introduction and kind of point out today's important, because if you don't hear what I'm going to talk about today, then honestly, the next few days, you won't understand almost anything I'll talk about, because I'm going to refer to a lot of the fallacies that I'll explain to you today and some of the basic misconceptions that exist. The sources that I use for this are a couple. There is the book written by Hamza Sources, which is Islam and Atheism and the known. It's a book, if you look it up, it's his basic book. Six Numbers is another book by Martin Ress. It's definitely worth reading. It's not a book of theology, but it's definitely a book worth reading if you want to understand how the universe works. I use a book called, it's an Arabic book written by Dr. Ahmed Khair Al-Umar. It's called Itma'inna Aqli. I was a part of actually helping the forum that actually helped this book be written initially, and a number of other sources, and some of my own material that I've been working on for a number of years. So inshallah, it's a mix of all of that. I will depend heavily on some of these sources more than others, depending on the episode or depending on the session that I'm giving and what I'm talking about. But altogether, inshallah, I'll try to paint a picture for you or give you the tools that you require, inshallah ta'ala, to deal with some of these challenges that we may face. So we'll start off by, I want to point out what the common reasons for disbelief are. I'm not going to use the word atheism, because I think the word atheism is just a part of a lot of other problems, like atheism, agnosticism, and then there's all these other subgroups and subtypes, and it's not worth kind of explaining all of them. It doesn't really matter. Let's just say disbelief. Either you accept Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and believe, or you don't. So what are the reasons for disbelief? And there are six main reasons. The number one reason is, simplistically, bad behavior. Bad behavior of those who take on faith. And this is not a problem I can fix, and that's not the point of this of these sessions, but it is the leading problem. If you take if you take the statistics and the surveys that are put out, Yaqeen Institute has a couple of them that you can actually access. The leading reason for people to lose their faith or for them to walk away from belief is just the bad examples that they see in front of them. And I'm not talking about anything severe. I'm just talking dishonesty from someone who should be honest, or the lack of commitment to a faith from someone who's preaching the faith. And just as a disclaimer, this session or this series is not designed for someone who doesn't believe in God at all, already made up their mind. This is not for them. If you already made up your mind, Do what you want to do. This is not for you. This is for those who either believe in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala but struggle, or someone who's somewhere in the middle, who's kind of falling back and forth, can't seem to figure things out, in the gray zone. those who don't believe in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, through my, like those who are completely made up their mind in one direction or the other, in my experience, no matter what you talk about, it doesn't really go anywhere. It's just a waste of time. But this series will offer some arguments, some thoughts, things to reflect upon that will allow someone maybe to go back. Because really, if you've made your decision in one way or the other, if you didn't make it based on logic or rationale, then there's really no point of view of any discussion actually occurring. But this is for those who actually are looking for something and have questions and actually want to follow something that makes sense to them, knowing that they're following a rationale and logic that is sound. So that's the number one reason. It's bad behavior. I can't fix that. That's not what we're going to talk about. But just so that you understand that's the number one reason. That's the leading reason of people losing their faith. It's bad behavior. It's a parent that tells a child to do something and they do the opposite. It's an imam who stands up and explains something, preaches something, and then they practice something different. It's someone who stands in the first line and tells people to come and pray, but then is not honest and trustworthy when it comes to money. This is the leading problem amongst people. Is it correct? No, that's not what I'm arguing here today. I'm not saying it's right. I'm saying it's the leading problem. I'm not here to argue whether it's correct. No, obviously it's wrong for someone to do that, but it is the leading problem. There are two ways to go by a problem. Either we can complain about it or we can acknowledge that it's there and try to affect it. Number two, cognitive dissonance. And it's when, what cognitive dissonance means, and it's a very important concept you need to understand, it's when your inherited beliefs, or a belief that you hold on to or you have, is challenged by a fact, a truth that you didn't have before. This truth that came to you, this fact, this very clear, undeniable, undisputable truth that came to you is going against the inherited belief that you carry. In that moment, you go into something called cognitive dissonance, where you believe something, or you've been believing something for a long time, or you've been living based on a specific maxim for a long time, and now you're presented with something that does not fit with it. And this thing that is presenting itself is very convincing. I mean, it's a fact that you can't, it's a truth, it's a reality that you cannot deny. So people go by different ways by going, people have different approaches to go to deal with this. Some people will drop their inherited belief and take what the fact that they have, and that's what a Muslim should do. A true Muslim will always do that. A true Muslim will always follow whatever is haqq, whatever it is, no matter how hard and no matter how difficult it is to follow haqq. Other people will look for ways to maybe put them together. Sometimes there are ways to put the inherited belief that you have and the truth that you're faced with by revising your inherited belief or understanding the truth a little bit better, and then you find out, okay, they don't actually contradict. There is a way for both of them to exist together. And then there's a third way where you just ignore the truth, where you just, you just kind of, wherever it moves, you just kind of make sure you don't look at it, don't think about it. You just put a little bit of a barrier, and you hold on to your inherited belief, which is the act of a kafir. Basically, in the Quran, when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is referring to a mukadhib or a kafir, he's referring to someone who does that, who has a reason to believe there's something obvious, but they don't want to listen to it. They don't want to hear it. And that's the example in the story of Ibrahim, thumma nukisu ala ru'usim, and I explained it a couple of nights ago before Tarawih. That's number two. So bad behavior, cognitive dissonance. Number three, is politicizing religious texts. Politicizing, meaning giving it an agenda, meaning using texts to achieve a certain goal. This is a little bit worse than bad behavior. Bad behavior is just someone who just doesn't, there's a lack of, there's a little bit of hypocrisy in how they're going by stuff. They're saying one thing, doing the other. Tasyis an-nusus ad-diniyah, which is the actual wording in Arabic at least, is basically is taking text and then trying to interpret it or use it in a way that serves a personal goal. Something that you want. You want people to believe a certain thing or behave in a certain way or to join a certain group. Or you want a way to control them. Or you want a way for them to submit to you. Or you want a way for them to be loyal to you. So you use text to achieve that for something personal. Anytime you use the Book of Allah or the Prophet ﷺ's words for a personal gain, you're corrupt. Anytime you do that as a Muslim, the moment you use it for something aside from guidance and helping others, then you've already entered the realm of corruption. And this has happened historically for a very long time. And this is why it's an important reason for al-had, because if you study history, you'll find this has happened a lot. This happened not only to Muslims, it happened to non-Muslims, and it happened almost all throughout history where political leaders will bring people of Islamic knowledge, put a nice big imamah on their head and say this and say that and use this piece of evidence and ignore that one, never read that one, never even bring that up, and then find another way to interpret that so it has no effect on people at all. This is a reason for people to lose belief because they can identify that hypocrisy and it causes them to kind of step away. Number four, the fourth reason of why people lose their faith or disbelieve in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is dhulm and is oppression. It's oppression, it's torture, it's horrific occurrences that that happen to people. When you're faced with brutality, when you're faced with some of the worst behavior, when you're faced with people being horrifically transgressed against and oppressed, sometimes if you don't have the proper psychological structure and the proper theological background, you can lose your faith really quickly. And this is why I put that there. And by the way, these six reasons, I didn't make them up. These are reasons that are actually, there are a lot of agencies in the world that survey people, not just Muslim agencies, like non-Muslim agencies and agencies in the West and in Europe. And these are the reasons for people not to believe in God, not just in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, for all faiths. And this specific reason that I'm sharing with you skyrocketed, this fourth reason, after 2010 in the Middle East. After what was called the Arab Spring, this reason wasn't on the map, and it went right up because people saw an amount of oppression and torture and killing and just brutality amongst human beings that it caused them to lose their faith because they weren't prepared for what was going to come. Even though historically this has always been a part of the world, nature is very brutal. Nature itself is extremely—it's animalistic. That's why we call them animals, because that's how they behave. So that's how nature works. And human beings, once they lose their ethics, they will just basically follow whatever animalistic tendencies they have in them, and they'll behave that way. So it's actually the fourth reason. The fifth reason is ISIS and all of its sisters and brothers, all those who are similar to it. ISIS is not a phenomenon that exists on its own. It existed for a long time. It started with the Khawarij back in the time of Sayyidina Ali ibn Talib. And it continuously existed where people go, they hijack Islamic or religious texts. And then you can say, well, that's the same thing as politicizing. No. So when they politicize texts, they're just trying to explain, they're trying to change a mentality, trying to get you to believe something that is not accurate from an Islamic perspective. Daesh or ISIS, they just start killing people. It's not bad behavior. Bad behavior was simple. Bad behavior is just someone who's not, is showing a little bit of hypocrisy. Someone who's saying something, doing something different. Someone who's making it difficult for you to accept what they teach you. But ISIS is a group of people that will go and take religious text, the pieces that really matter to them, and then they will use it to actually start chopping heads off and killing people in the hundreds and the thousands. And definitely, as a phenomenon, they are one of the leading reasons for people to lose their faith. And I and the last two I've witnessed myself. Like the last two I saw with my own eyes. I watched people walk away because of certain things that occurred. And the sixth and final one are specific mentalities, specific ways of thought. I'm going to have to unpack that one a little bit. So number six, I'm going to give you four ways of thought that will lead to disbelief. Again, I'm telling you about the reasons why people disbelieve. I'm not saying that they're right. I'm not defending them. This is what they are. When bad behavior in the name of religion happens, people tend to disbelieve. When there's cognitive dissonance, when you're faced with the truth and your inherited belief does not fit it, you lose your faith. Understanding what I'm trying to say? These are the reasons of why people will lose their faith. When you use religious text or an agenda and people pick up on the fact that you're doing it for a personal reason, they lose their faith. When horrific oppression and horrific torture happens in front of you, you lose your faith. These are just reasons that happen. I'm not defending them, but that's what happens. And we'll talk about them. We'll unpack them slowly throughout the series, inshallah. But the sixth reason, which is certain mentalities or ways of thought. There's four ways of thought specific. There's a lot of ways, but these four personality traits are very important because I see them a lot in our Muslim community, and I'm always worried about a person who shows one of these four ways of thought. So number one, those who are mechanistic. Meaning they only see things through mechanisms. Meaning some philosophers call it the denial of the intuition. So there's the intuitive mind, and then there is the materialistic mind that is can only see things through formulas and numbers. But then there's there's intuition. If you only see things through materialistic measures, that's all the only way you can understand anything, the only way you'll acknowledge anything to be real, then there's a lot about life that you can't see, and you can't feel, and can't experience. And people, and those who have that way of thought, they don't only disbelieve in God. They end up having a lot of problems with their relationships because when it comes to emotion and feelings and love and thoughts, they're not good at really identifying with that. They end up losing their connection to it. And the funny thing is that the scientific method, which is what people who are very, very mechanistic in their way they think, they hide behind the scientific method. The funny thing about the scientific method is that the scientific method, most of it is based on intuition. All of research, not some of it, all of research is based on intuition. You have to have a hypothesis. Ever heard of that? You have to have a hypothesis. What's a hypothesis? It's intuition. I think this will affect that. Why? I don't know. I'm going to try and do a trial to see if it's true or not, but it's based on intuition. Every major invention in history, and this is not just in medicine where in my field, but in every other discipline, was based on intuition. It was something that the person, your subconsciousness is really good at absorbing everything and then giving you a hunch. It's a hunch, it's a feeling. This probably, these two things work. You can't prove it yet, but later you try and you go, but you wouldn't, how would you go by actually putting these two things together? How would you go by actually figuring out that insulin can, where would that, the scientific method does not give you an approach to how to do it. The scientific method tells you how you're going to actually properly measure it. You're going to take someone who has diabetes, you're going to try insulin, and you're going to see if it's actually going to work. The scientific method teaches you how to do that. But where do you come up with the hypothesis that that may even work? Science doesn't give you that. Science doesn't have that tool. It's the intuition, it's the human intuition that allows that. So anyone who kind of completely denies that piece in life, they don't end up denying it everywhere. They only deny it regarding God. But it leads to ilhad. It leads to a certain degree of disbelief. That's the first one. Number two is the problem of metaphor blindness, is what they call it. In Arabic, al-harfiyya, is where you can only understand things literally. Nothing, there's no metaphor in your life. There's no figure of speech in anything that is being said. And whenever a figure of speech is given, it doesn't make any sense to the person listening to it. Metaphor blindness is definitely one of the mentalities that will lead to disbelief. And historically in Islam, there's always been a little bit of a debate on this. The majority of scholars obviously believe in something called majaz, which is metaphors or figures of speech. But there are a group of Muslims who stopped doing that. And Dawood al-Zahiri, who was the first person to come up with this, and later on his student Ibn Hazm al-Zahiri, who didn't do it fully but did maybe 60% of it, came up with this hypothesis. They started saying that no, the Quran is only literal. There is no metaphor at all. And I'll give you an example of how far that can go and how crazy that will sound to you. The hadith of the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam, talking about marriage, in order for her to be married, قَالَ وَإِذْنُ الْبِكْرِ صَمْتُهَا. That's the hadith in Bukhari and Muslim and others. And the permission that a virgin young lady will give for marriage is when she's bashful and she's quiet. She doesn't say anything, right? They took this literally, to the point where if she said, I accept, it doesn't account. If she says, I accept, no, she has to be quiet in order, because it's literal. And you're saying, that's insane. Like, you're listening to that, you're laughing, this is stupid. Yes, but a literal mind will fail to be able to understand the metaphor in what he said, alayhi salatu wasalam. He said that sometimes she'll be bashful. She won't want to say to her father in her face, yes, I want fulan. She'll find that a little bit too difficult, so she'll just kind of be quiet, and it'll be understood that she's accepting this. She's not saying no, because she doesn't want it, she'll say no. So the Prophet, alayhi salam, metaphorically is explaining something. And then if you understand it literally, if she says, yes, yeah, Baba, I want him, then that means no, because you weren't quiet at the time. No one accepts that, but not no one. There are people who do think in that manner. So metaphor blindness is a reason. It's a mentality. It's a way of thought that can lead to lack of disbelief. Number three, the everything or nothing problem. They call it uncertainty avoidance. This is what they, again, these are philosophical terms. If you go study, you can Google all these terms I'm giving you, and you'll find like Wikipedia pages that will explain them in detail. Or if not Wikipedia pages, you'll find philosophical pages that will talk about these things. Uncertainty avoidance. This is a big problem. I see this all the time. I see this in people who, sorry, it's been something in my tongue since I got in here. And that's not going to make it any better. No, you can't. It's a feather of some sort. Something's on. It's a hair or something. Uncertainty avoidance is when you can't accept that not everything is 100% clear. And Muslims who have that problem, I watch them. I watch them enter Islam, then I watch them become radicalized, then I watch them follow three or four different very specific types of thought, ways of thought, that are, and then I watch them leave Islam altogether. Because when you cannot accept that some things do not have full certainty, you can't deal with life. In Islam, there's a lot of things that do have full certainty. And then we have a lot of stuff that are probabilistic, that I just have a lot high probabilities and low probabilities. This happens to me in the cancer world all the time. When patients come in and I don't have certainty, I can't tell them if they're 100% going to be cured of this. They can't wrap their heads around it. They get upset. They get physically upset. They become combative. And they don't want you anymore as a physician. They want someone else. Because you explain to them the prognosis of your disease is this much percent. And the chance of this working is around 75%. And if we do this, then it'll become 85%. It looks at you. No, what are you talking about? Either I'm going to be cured or not. No, I don't have that. Like, I can't say for sure. And that's not acceptable. And that way of thought, either everything or nothing, if you take that and you apply it to faith or to religion or to science or to anything, it can cause a lot of problems. To faith, to science, it'll just cause you to fight with scientists and doctors and hate them and then become an anti-vaxxer or something like that. But for a Muslim, it causes you to leave Islam altogether. Because there are things in the deen that are designed not to be certain, to have some ambiguity. That's what he wanted, subhanahu wa ta'ala. That's how he put it there. But some people don't accept that. Not all pieces of evidence have 100% authenticity. People who don't understand that will either say the hadith al-sahih means it's equal to the Quran, or it's da'if and it needs to be thrown away. And they don't know how to deal with anything in between, which most pieces of evidence outside of the Quran are like that. They're somewhere in between. So they need a mind that is capable of seeing the gray area, to see something that is percentage-based, not necessarily 100% or zero. And a lot of Muslims today, that's how they see the car thing, that it either goes this way or that way. There's nothing in the middle. No, you have to have the ability to come somewhere in the middle. The fourth mentality way or thought process is called the Nirvana fallacy, or the perfect or the ideal catalog, different names. And I'm using it here not as a fallacy, because it's actually a way of thought. I'll give you an example of where this actually becomes a problem. So those who say God is merciful, they have to see acts of mercy at all times, in all across the board, for everything. And if one act is not merciful, then they don't believe in God anymore. The problem with that is that who told you that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is going to be showing compassion at every single moment? And who said that the standard of compassion is something that you get to put? Who allowed you to say, this is the standard of compassion? He has to meet the standard. This is the ideal standard that I believe is correct. So God has to either meet the standard or I don't believe in him. And that is basically the Nirvana problem, or the fallacy, where you set the standard, you set the expectation, and if the God that you're being told to believe in does not meet that expectation, you refuse the God. Well, that's not a problem of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It's a problem of your expectations. Who gave you the right to make these expectations? Who gave you the right to make the definitions to begin with? So that's the Nirvana fallacy, and it happens a lot as well. Probably the everything or nothing is more common amongst Muslims, but this is also common amongst Muslims, unfortunately, where they set an expectation of God, and if Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala does not meet their expectation, then they don't want to believe in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala anymore. And that's very, very, very dangerous. So those are the four ways of thought. So just know them, just so you can think about them. People who understand things only literally. They have metaphor blindness. They're not able to see anything else. Those who are mechanistic, they can only see things through materialistic. They don't believe in the intuitive mind at all. Those who either all in or all out, they call that the uncertainty avoidance way of thought. And then the Nirvana fallacy. These ways of thought are problematic. They do lead commonly to people leaving the faith. And this is data that I'm pulling from different sources. It's not just Islamic. This is something that happens even outside of Islam. So it's important for you to kind of watch out for personality traits in yourself. If you like that, you kind of figure out why. So those are the six major reasons for why people disbelieve in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We're going to unpack all of them by talking about how to actually gain belief in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala appropriately. So, but knowing them up front is just for you to have a little bit of a map. The other thing I need you to know today are 8 common fallacies. You know what a fallacy is? It's a trick. It's a logical trick that is used to fool someone to think something is correct when it isn't. And it's called a fallacy for a reason. And this is all of these fallacies, by the way, are not built by Islamic scholars, even though there are parallels within Islamic literature for them, but I'm not going to pull them from that. I'm going to pull them actually just from modern day philosophy. There's a lot of fallacies, but I'm going to point out 8 of them that are going to be important for us. They're going to affect a lot of these discussions that we're going to have over the next few days. So the number one fallacy is something called the argumentum ad hominem. And this means when you're arguing something, instead of arguing the point, you argue the person. This is done by both non-disbelievers and believers. And it's mostly seen in politics. Someone's bringing a point. Instead of arguing the point, we'll argue the person. We'll say that this person is this and this person is that. And we start pointing out the flaws of character of the person who's making the argument instead of actually listening to the argument. And that happens a lot. That's a big problem. For example, I'll give you an example of that. A scholar who's making a very good argument about something, it makes a lot of sense, but then they go into his past and they found that at one point he said this, or he behaved like that, or he had a second marriage and then he divorced the wife or something. Then we discredit everything this person ever said. Or we find that at some point, politically, he was on this side and not on the right side. We discredit the point he made based on his character, which is a fallacy. That's not, philosophically, that's not acceptable. Forget about being haram or not. No, I mean, let's just understand from a logical perspective. Logically, that's not okay. You don't have to like the person. The person can be a complete garbage can. But if the point they're making is worthy of making, then we have to argue the point. So that's the first one, ad hominem, they call that. Number two, the straw man fallacy. Straw man fallacy, which, and I'm going to give a big example for it tomorrow, maybe today if I have time. But the straw man fallacy is where you don't want to argue the other person's point. You're going to explain his point in a flawed way and then argue the flaws in the way that you've explained his point. So instead of actually arguing with Islam the way I'm going to, with Islam, no, you're going to paint a flawed, horrible picture of Islam, and then you're going to poke holes in the actual painting that you've made. Instead of actually saying, okay, what is Islam? Here's what Islam is, and then poke points at that, or poke holes into that, or argue the points within Islam. No, that's too difficult. Let's just paint a flawed, misconceptual picture of Islam, and then we can point at flaws. Because we put the flaws in there, so it's easy for us to point them out. It's not a problem anymore. And that is one of the most common policies by far. Not only used against Islam, but used by Muslims as well. This is, every fallacy I'm going to give you goes both ways. Non-religious people use it and religious people use it too. Like, we are just as bad. Like, we use these fallacies all the time to argue against certain points that are being made. If an atheist is standing and making a point, you go back and say, look at him. Look how many relationships he has, 6 children outside of marriage. He was a drug addict for this long. What does that have to do with the point he's making? I understand he had a, you know, made some bad choices, but how does that affect the actual point? And a lot of people don't understand. That fallacy is very problematic. The straw man fallacy is where we don't want to actually see something for the way it is. We want to make our own understanding of it. Let's make up our own story of it. And then we'll poke holes on that story. And people will be very happy if I sit here and tell you, let me talk to you about the problems of, you know, faith X. And I don't know much about this faith, but I'll paint a picture. A picture that is filled with flaws, to the point where I don't even need to point out the flaws. You're already picking up on them as I tell you about the faith. But the problem is that this picture I painted is not the truthful representation of that faith. That's called the straw man fallacy. Remember that, because it's going to come up a lot with us. It's going to come up time and time again, where a lot of the problems that we have with believing in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, in history and in Islam, it comes from the straw man fallacy, where someone is just painting or building a picture that is not the right. It's not true. It's not true. Of course, you're going to find 100 flaws, because it's not true. It's very simple. Number three, the red herring fallacy. Red herring is a type of a fish, and all it means, I don't care about where it came from. Just know what it is, because it's important. Red herring fallacy is when we're arguing a point, and instead of arguing the point, we do a distraction. Something distracts you. Red herring is a red fish, so you're looking at the fish because it's red, and then you forget what you're actually looking at to begin with. So it's when we distract an argument with something different. So I'm starting talking to you about why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is a fact of the universe, and we're talking about the importance of la ilaha illallah, there's nothing to, and you're like, well, why did the Prophet marry Aisha when she was young? What does that have to do with this? It has nothing to do, but this is a good distractor. Oh yeah, why did he have all these wives? Yeah, what does that have to do with the existence of God? Nothing. It has nothing to do with it. But it's a good distractor. It's very powerful. It'll make everyone, yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, why is that? And then you come and you ask the question, and then we've lost track of what we're doing anymore. That's why I hate when I have to have these conversations. When someone says, oh, my son or my daughter needs to talk to you, they're losing their faith. I'm like, oh, it's only 15 minutes. I'm like, no, it's like 15 hours. It's not 15 minutes. We're not doing it in Ramadan because it's not 15 minutes. It's not 15 minutes. I know what this is. It's going to be, I'm going to be running around, like a circus. I have to run around to get the person just to focus on one thing. Look. You not believe in God? Okay, we'll talk about that. Don't grin me other stuff, because that's not relevant to the argument. But every time they lose the argument or they feel they're losing, they'll go to, it's called the red herring fallacy. It's very important. Number four, I hope you remember all of them because they're important. It is called the argumentum ad populum, which is the opposite or not different than the ad hominem. The ad populum is when you state something to be true just because a lot of people agree to it. Just because a lot of common people agree to it, then it must be true. Meaning you draw the strength of your argument not through the logic of your argument, but through numbers. There's a lot of people who agree in something. And that's never been the case. Islamically, we don't believe that ever. Like, it's not a part of our deen. Obviously, it goes against all revolutionary movements historically, but it's very well used. And it's a very powerful tool. If you say, look, the number of people who believe in something, as Muslims, our strength isn't in the fact there's 2 billion Muslims. No, it has nothing to do with that. Because other faith can say, well, we have 2.5 billion. Does that make us more correct? What about the Prophet ﷺ had barely had a couple of people for 13 years? That make him less correct? No. So numbers don't matter here. But it's a very common fallacy that is going to be based on numbers. The opposite of that is called the snob approach fallacy, where they flip, the table is flipped in terms of the fallacy itself. Say, no, it's correct because only a small number agree with this, or only a small number believe in it. That's why it must be correct. Muslims do this more than non-Muslims. Muslims do this by saying, they use a hadith like, لا تزال طائفة من أمتي ظاهرين على الحق. There will always be a small group of Muslims that will stand by haq. So they'll say, well, I am a part of a small group, so thus I must be correct. Because all the rest of the Muslims don't stand by this group, so they must be. And then the other people are like, well, you're a part of a small group, we're a part of the big group, so we're correct. So each group is claiming being correct just based on numbers. One is saying, because the snob approach, so there's a small group, they must be right. Or a small group of scientists all believe this, that must be the right thing because there's a small group of them and everyone else is corrupt and everyone else is brainwashed and these are the people who know it. These are not appropriate ways to argue logical points. Logical points aren't argued through these fallacies. They're argued through logic, through rationale, which is what we're going to try to do, inshallah, we're going to do, inshallah ta'ala. Definitely not through a fallacy. But these two fallacies are the opposite, but they're very important because they happen all the time. And we tend to find comfort in them. We tend to find comfort in either large numbers or small numbers. And people who adhere to these fallacies in their mind end up actually losing their faith once they are outnumbered. Right? People who just go by numbers will lose their faith if they're a striking minority. They'll end up losing their faith. Or vice versa. People who don't like to be a part of the bigger group. They don't like being part of a group that's big. They want to be part of a very elite, snob group. So they look for that. And they're like, oh, you believe in that too? So they lose interest in that belief. They want to find something that is very elite and small. So these are problems that actually exist in the mentality of people. So how many have done those? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So this is 6. We have 2 more. Or 3 more, actually. That is 5. So the one I'm talking is appealing to emotion. The appealing to emotion fallacy. We do this more than non-Muslims by far. Like, believers do this more than disbelievers by far. Where you're talking to someone, instead of arguing the points of belief in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you tell them, what about Nar? And what about Jannah? And you start emotionally, this actually backfires. Someone who's logical will immediately, you know, be repelled by that argument. If they're trying to argue a logical point, and you start to insert emotion into your argument, and you stop actually arguing the point logically and rationally, you insert emotion, you repel them. They start because that is a sign of a weak argument. An argument that requires a loud voice or requires appealing to emotion is an argument that does not have a lot of merit. An argument that makes sense, that is sound, does not require any of that. It will generate later on emotion, totally. A sound argument will later generate genuine emotion. But you can't build an argument based on emotion. So appealing to emotion is one of the mistakes that Muslim speakers have been making for the last 150 years. I tend to avoid it on the minbar. It's not hard to stand and recite the verses that are going to make people cry. It's not very difficult. It's actually very easy. And the majority of people will love it. And you'll become very famous and very popular very quickly because you just appeal to the right feelings that people have, whether it's love or fear or whatever it may be. But you don't build a sound foundation of faith by doing that. Because emotion can be swayed. One day it's swayed this way, the other day it'll be swayed that way. And I grew up in an environment where that was how it was happening. And it never made sense to me. I never liked it. Because the artificial aspect of it was too clear. It was too obvious. Because there was a weakness in the foundation of belief. So we're just going to ignore that and just going to, you know, make people emotional about things. Tell them stories that will fill them with either pride or fill them with motivation because of someone who said this or did that. And that doesn't last very long. It can work for a while. Doesn't last very long. Appealing to emotion is a very, very, very dangerous fallacy that we are very guilty of committing. The point after that is called the historian's fallacy. The historian fallacy is where we hold historic figures or historic people to standards that we just came up with now. This is a big, big one. So I'll give you an example of it. Slavery. Slavery is not a good thing, obviously. No one's disagreeing with that. Even back then, they didn't disagree with that. But there was a system back in the day that allowed it to exist, in a system that where people owned slaves. Especially in Arabia, by the way, slaves weren't of a specific race or color. In Arabia, slaves were everybody. Arabs were enslaved, Romans were enslaved, everyone was enslaved. It was like open source for everybody. Everyone could be enslaved. So when I look back at the historic events or historical figures that existed 1,000 or 2,000 years ago, and I judge them based on how we see slavery today, that's a fallacy because it's not fair. Because they didn't have the same context that we have. Nor do we have the same context that they had. I mean, we don't understand what it means to live in a specific time and a specific place. We don't understand. So we can't hold them to our standards, just like they can't hold us to their standards. I'm going to give you something to make you think a little bit. 500 years from now, if humanity doesn't kill itself, and we still didn't fry this planet completely, we will look back, people will look back at our generation and say they drove cars. They drove cars. They put fuel, and then they burnt fuel and sent it into the, and they completely fry the ozone layer, and that's why we can't get out of our houses anymore. And they'll look at us as evil, as idiots, but that's not fair. That's not fair. Maybe we're wrong. Huh? We could easily say, yeah, I'm probably wrong. Like we probably shouldn't be burning all this coal. We can agree to that. But are we evil for doing it? Are you saying what I'm saying? That historian fallacy is a problem. They can't judge us basically. They're not in the part of our context. There's so much here that they don't understand. There's so many details that they can't, because they're not here. Just like we can't judge them. And that's important. When you look at historic eras, judging people based on standards or values or principles that you came up with or is clear to you now, that wasn't clear back then, or there was a different context to it back then, is not fair. And that happens a lot. And a lot of scientific papers and scholars of sociology and psychology and other will use it quite often. Like you'll find it very widespread in papers, and it's a very simple fallacy that you can pick up on if you just understand that it's there. And the final one, the eighth one, is the complex question fallacy. This is an important one because it's going to come up a couple of times. Here's what I mean. So you're not married, right? You're not married. So if I say so, yes or no, answer the question. How do you beat your wife? You slap her or punch her in the face? Yes or no? Yes or no? You can't answer the question because you're not even married. And if you were married, you don't hit your wife. So there's so many wrong things in this question. Like this question cannot be answered. Like it's not proper. So if I ask this question to a married person or someone with a child, tell me, how do you discipline, beat your child? Do you slam it into the wall or do you step on their foot? What do you do? Yes or no? Yes or no? You can't answer this question. What do you mean yes or no? I don't do that at all. I can't answer. This is a complex question fallacy where you make a question complex and then you force a type of answer and there's no way to answer it. This happens also in religion. Can God create a rock he can't move? Yes or no? Can he create a God? What are you doing? This question doesn't make any sense. Do you understand what the word create means? Create means when you create something, that means it's under you. It's below you. It's beneath you. That's what create means. For you to create something that you can't control, that's not creation anymore. That's something else. That's development. Human beings, we develop stuff that can be stronger than us. We can't create. No one has created anything no human being has made nothingness to somethingness. That's never happened. So the word create is very specific. So this question is in its essence, not a question that can be answered. It's a philosophical fallacy. Philosophers have known this for a very long time. Like I'm talking 6,000, 7,000 years ago. Aristotle talked about these things. Socrates talked about these things. None of this is new. This is the weird part. That nothing I've shared with you so far is actually in any form or manner new. All very, very ancient and old. It's a part of understanding what philosophy is. But because these tricks are fun, see? I got you to say no. It's a fun trick. It's a fun trick. It's a really easy trick. Because if you don't know the trick, you'll fall into it. All of these fallacies are tricks that work. People will fall to them just because they didn't study appropriate. They didn't study logic. Logic. If you, how many of you have taken logic in school? So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. See, it's not mandatory. A lot of people didn't take logic in school, which is to me the most insane thing ever. How do you not study some degree of philosophy to understand how to actually critically think about things and how to pick up on stuff on these type of mistakes? Because these type of mistakes are real. The straw man fallacy happens all the time in your life, all the time. Mothers and fathers who are divorced do it to their children all the time. They paint an ugly picture of the spouse and then they point and they poke holes at it. Okay? Abuk is like this, Ummik is like this. They're not. But if they're like that, then it's easier for me to actually prove that they're not good anymore. But I'm not going to paint the actual picture of the person because then I'm going to end up not being able to show as many flaws and my argument kind of fails. It happens all the time. Like, it's a part of everyday life. We do it all the time. We do it all the time. Friends do it to each other, do it amongst all the time. So if you learn a little bit of this, how this, and when you have debates, red herring fallacy happens all the time too. When someone's losing, if they're skilled, they have in their back pocket a red herring. And once they're losing the argument, they'll throw it out. Forgive me, sisters, you're really good at that. You're really good at that. I've been married for 12 years. It's really good at that. Whenever you're getting cornered in the argument, you always have a secret weapon. You always have something ready. In case the argument's not going to go your way, you throw that out. Then I have to deal with that piece. But that has nothing to do with the point. And now we're all distracted. And now everyone's upset. And now we have to just apologize and move on. So it's a really good, it's a very good way. But it's a fallacy. It's fine in marriages, honestly, because that's what keeps people together. But it's not okay with logic and belief in God and that stuff. It's a very unhealthy thing. Okay, with that being said, I'll say this. Looking for God within science is like fishing in a swimming pool. The swimming pool is really cool. It's really cool. It has all these technology stuff. It's like a jacuzzi. It's clean water. It's what? But there's no fish in there. When you search for God in science, you're not going to find him. Because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the concept of God, and this is not just how we understand it, is all those who actually take their faith seriously enough to define a deity or a supreme power, as in not being something that is contained within space-time. It can't. Because space-time is nothing but a creation. If science was to ever come up with an equation of physical proof of God, then whatever science is proving, or whatever is on the other side of that equation, by default isn't God. If you're able to prove it scientifically, then it's not God. So those who are looking for God in science, not only are you never going to find God there, if you find something that you think is God, just by the fact that you found it, it's not God anymore. Because it's contained, because science does not have reach outside of space-time. It can't. Science is only interested in the observable universe. It doesn't care about anything outside of that. Science is very, very specific in its its focus. On the other hand, philosophy is what allows us to think outside of the realms of existence that we actually are able to look at. And that's why you have to look for God in the right place. If you're looking in science, so what is it? What's the point of science? Offers you the signs. It offers you the arrows. You're not going to have physical scientific proof. You're not going to have equations of God. I know some people don't like that, by the way. Some people get very offended when they hear that. But this is the truth of the matter. Honestly, walking in, again, that goes back to the mentality of thought, right? That first one, where the intuitive mind doesn't exist. It has to be mechanistic. Muslims who think that way, no, there is proof of God scientifically. No, there isn't. If there were, then whatever science is proving is not God. Like, it's actually a conundrum. It doesn't work that way. You cannot prove within the universe the existence of something that doesn't exist in the universe. There's no sense in that at all. But if you have a mechanistic mindset or mentality or perspective, then this is going to be very difficult for you. You're going to struggle with that. So you look for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala outside of that in philosophy. But what science does is science provides all of the signs and the arrows, meaning everything is pointing in the same direction. If you have enough elements pointing in the same direction, then you know that what it is that you believe in is the correct thing. And that's why the Quran doesn't talk about proof of God. It talks about ayat. Ayat means signs. There's a difference between the two things. The Quran is very, very, very accurate and precise with the wordings it uses when it talks about stuff. It talks about ayat. Ayat will be many, and we'll talk about that, and we'll explain how that works for you. The sources of faith, there are four major sources of faith, which we'll be unpacking over the next 6 days, and kind of going through all of the common shubuhat or intellectual challenges that exist and some of the arguments that are out there and how to deal with them, inshallah. I can't go through everything, obviously. It's a huge topic, but I'll try to go through the ones that are most common that you're going to hear almost all the time if you're going to school or university or you're working or you're just watching TV. These days, everyone finds no problem mocking any religious beliefs and saying things. So some of the arguments that are used are just very simple stuff that you just need to understand where it's coming from and how to deal with. There are four major sources. Number one, the universe, meaning existence in itself. Number two, life specifically, the existence of life. Number three, history. And number four, the intuition or the personal experiences of the human being, meaning yourself, something on the inside. These are the four sources of iman that exist in the Quran. What you're going to find in all four sources is that all four of them are pointing directly in the exact same direction. And when all four point in the same direction, you end up with what iman is going to be. The iman is when you have a lot of evidence for something. You don't have proof, but you have a lot of evidence, overwhelming evidence. But without proof, you have to believe in what the evidence is pointing at based on faith. That's what iman is. It's using your mind to say, I don't have something in my hand. I don't have something. I wasn't there. I didn't witness the actual thing itself. But I have enough evidence that what I'm talking about. And this happens all the time in courts of law. All the time. Someone is murdered. Sometimes you don't have proof, as in footage of the person doing it or admission or... But they have a lot of evidence. They have motives, and they have someone existing at a specific time, or someone saw someone at a specific hour. All these, enough arrows pointing at the same person is enough to get someone a full conviction, almost with 100% certainty in these cases. And when it comes to belief in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, it's the same thing. It's the same thing, which is why he call it iman. So why doesn't he just make it, okay, we'll talk about that. Why didn't just make it? There would be no point of iman to begin with. What's the point of iman? There's no point. There's no point of this whole existence. If Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala was going to present himself, say, here it is. Then what's the point? We're just like the malaika. There's no point of this whole journey that we're going to be on as human beings. The malaika are there with God. They don't have to believe in God. They don't have to believe. They're right there. I'll point out to you in the Quran how the malaika, rarely does Allah ever use the concept of iman with malaika. It's only once, and it has specific context that I'll show you. But otherwise, why would they? They're right there. They're in that realm. But you and I aren't. So we have to have iman. Iman is not going to be based on fallacies. It's not going to be based on whims or desires. It's going to be based on evidence. It's going to be based on signs that are overwhelming. That all point. If one sign was pointing in the opposite direction, we wouldn't have to believe. If one sign was pointing in an opposite direction that there's no God, then we wouldn't have to believe. But all of them are pointing in the exact same direction. And we'll go through, inshallah, these points starting tomorrow. We'll start with talking about the universe, inshallah ta'ala. And then we'll cover the ones after. I'll try to make it a little bit shorter than this, inshallah ta'ala. I don't know what time did I start. What time did I start? I don't know what time it was. It's after 6. Oh, so that's a bit long. So I'll try to keep it maybe around 40 to 45 minutes, inshallah ta'ala. So this is what I think we should do. I think you should let me get through maybe two or three episodes of this before you start asking me a million questions, because a lot of the questions you're going to ask me, I will cover. Like, you'll find a lot of them will be covered just because this is a lot of preparation for this. But after the third lesson, if there's questions about the specific concept that we talked about that still isn't there, I'll answer. And if there's any questions about what I just talked about, then you're welcome to answer. Not questions outside of what I talked about. Don't bring me something that we haven't approached yet or tackled yet. But anything about the fallacies or the reasons for disbelief or the sources of belief in general, you're welcome to ask any of those questions. Do you have something yourself? Go ahead, Neil. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. 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 And then no, you ascend beyond that. You start there. You start with that. You're just looking at all that is around you. You're taking your faith from the sources that are available to you, the universe, life, your personal experiences, history. And then when you actually develop a relationship with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you go way beyond that. Meaning you're no longer stuck within that little realm of just basing it on the evidence that you saw. You're actually basing it on something much more personal to you. So you can ascend that by far. You can go from yaqeen to ilm yaqeen to haqq yaqeen with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which is what we'll talk about, inshallah, as well, as we come closer to the end of this this series. We'll point that out. But again, that comes from the same fallacy or the same mentality I was talking about, which is the mechanistic one. If the only reason you can believe in something 100% is if there is materialistic proof of it or a mechanistic description of it, then that not only will you not be able to believe in God, but you won't be able to believe in a lot of other things. Because there's a lot of other things that don't follow that rule. There's a ton of things in life that don't follow that rule, that don't have proof. Love is one of them, for example. And that's why today, the more time moves forward, you find that this narrative is increasing. It wasn't as loud as it was today. It's not the majority, but it's an increasing narrative of love not being real anymore. That it's just attraction and sex, and nothing else matters. And the only love that is real is between like maybe a parent and a child, and everything else is all made up, and there's no essence to it. It's not genuine. And that comes from basically this mentality, this way of thought. That you can't prove it. There's nothing you can. I can't hold it. I don't know what it, there's no equation to explain what love is. So it must not be real, right? The freedom of choice is another example of that. Today, a lot of neuroscientists, especially those who follow philosophically an atheist approach, are coming out and saying that there is no such thing as choice. We're just the collective reactions of our neurological system, predispositions, and genetic backgrounds. So that we're just a collective mesh of all those things. We don't even make any choices. I remember. I don't like doing debates, and I haven't done them in a long time, and I don't plan to go back and doing them again. It's just a waste of life and time, and I feel like I'm just wasting time doing them. But I had a discussion with one of those who had this. It was a PhD in neurosciences, and we were having this discussion, and he was trying to prove. So at the end of the discussion, I actually have it still on my phone somewhere because he had sent me this message at the end. Like we had talked, and then he would text me back and forth. This is like years ago, and he told me. Well, he said, I feel like you seem so intelligent. Why is it that you still believe in God? I told him, because I have freedom of choice. That's why. You didn't get the point here. his whole argument with me is that there's no freedom of choice in the world. I'm like, yeah, well, the reason I don't have it is because I have freedom of choice. Maybe you don't, and that's why you don't want to believe in God. But it was an argument that just transcended, I think, a certain degree. Sorry, the joke didn't. But that, when he was trying to prove that he didn't have freedom of choice, like I'm like, well, if I don't have freedom of choice, then why are you talking to me? What's the point of this discussion? Like, if there's no freedom of choice, I'm gonna believe in what I believe in. You're gonna believe in what you're gonna believe in. Why are we gonna keep on doing this? And if you think it's weird that I don't believe in something, it's because I do have, inshallah, freedom of choice, and I identify that in myself, and maybe you don't identify that in yourself. Yes, collective groups of people will behave in certain ways, and you can predict it, and that's why we have epidemiology and statistics, and we have that as a science. But that doesn't predict how each and every individual will behave. It doesn't tell us how each and every person will choose. Collective behavior is there, and that's something even the Quran talks about, and that's fine. And that's why we perform da'wah, and that's why we have laws. The point of having a law is because you predict a collective behavior will occur unless you have a law that will prevent it from happening. So laws only exist because collective behavior is a thing. It doesn't mean that people don't have freedom of choice. And I'm just giving you examples of where a mechanistic approach, which is similar to what Muhammad was asking about, will make it impossible for you to believe in God. Like, if I don't have proof, I can never be certain. That's not true. That's not true. There's a lot in life that exists that we fully believe in, we fully accept, and we don't have materialistic proof for. That's totally fine. A lot of life is like that, and that's not a problem. But you have a lot of evidence. How do you think science works? Science is not based, most of the time, it lacks that proof, but it has evidence. It has evidence of things that were tried, and then effect, cause, and effect, and consequence, and repeated number of times. You see a pattern. We still don't know how it works. We still don't understand exactly what's happening, but we can see the repetition of the same thing. So we have evidence, and that evidence is enough for us to make a drug and allow it to be manufactured, and then we give it to human beings. What is it? It's leaking. Is that a sign or? Okay, any more questions? Yes, go ahead, dude. The snob approach. This snob fallacy, which is where we believe in something to be correct if a very small group, elite group. Yes, the opposite of that. And both groups, by the way, both people have both fallacies. Are amazing to watch them argue. Because they're both very, very certain about their beliefs just based on the opposite fallacy. One is certain because they're a part of the bigger group, and one is certain because it's small part of the small group, and neither of them are arguing the point. Neither of them are actually arguing the point that needs to be argued. I mean, no one's debating the evidence regarding this point. They're just arguing. They're just arguing their fallacy. So it's a really interesting thing. I've witnessed it a few times in within Islamic, unfortunately, realms where people do that. Any other questions? Again, just about this stuff. Yeah, go ahead, Tilda. So this is called the complicated term fallacy. And this happens a lot. I didn't talk about it because it's not as common for us, but you're correct. Is where you just use big words. You just use really big words and very complex terms. And you make something that is very simple seem very, very complex. So the person in front of you has no idea what to say because they feel stupid. They feel like, oh, I should know all these words, but I don't understand what they mean. So I must be wrong. And the person who's just playing around. And doctors are really good at that. We do that. We come into the office, we give you a lot of mumbo jumbo. It's a lot of scientific stuff. And because we don't want you to ask less questions so we can get through the day, a good physician will try to break it down into something very simple so you can understand it, and then you can ask the question that you want to ask. But if it's 6 o'clock and I want to go home, so I just give you a lot of mumbo jumbo and you'll be sitting there like, okay, you know best, doctor, and then we move on with stuff. That's a good example. And I think the slavery piece, we'll unpack, that's going to be talked about maybe at the last, either the fifth or sixth or seventh session. I'll talk about some of things that happened historically that need to be unpacked, and I'll talk about it in more detail. But I just gave it an example for certain types of fallacies where the historian fallacies used there a lot when it comes to slavery, because we don't understand exactly what it is, we don't understand the context, we don't understand why it occurred, what was it based on, and we don't understand why it was acceptable for a certain amount of time. We're just going to judge people based on the fact that now we think it's fully wrong. Which is correct, it is wrong, it's bad, it's an evil thing. No one's even remotely debating that. But what existed at a time, you need to understand the context for that before you judge everybody. Doesn't it sound really weird to judge a full population or to judge all of human race during a certain period of time or something? I think that's a little bit, I don't think that's appropriate. I don't think that's a smart thing to do. We can do it, you can try it, but it's not appropriate. Anything else? Yes. Believe to start. I didn't follow. Yeah. So you don't start there. You never start there, which is what I'll talk about tomorrow. So you never start with emotion or intuition. You always start with the basics, with the evidence. You start with the four sources. You start in this sequence. You start with universe, life, history, and then personal experiences. You have to start in that sequence in order for things to work for you. So if you start in the wrong sequence, you say, okay, your personal life, well, what if you had a really crappy life? A lot of people do. A lot of people have difficult stories. They grew up, they were orphaned at a young age, they went through a lot of difficulty, they were abused. Does that mean they don't believe in God? No, that means something different. It means something, that's not what they're going to take from that. So you have to go through the right sequence of things. You have to start from the right starting point. Yeah. Yes, there's no one else. Very simply, just to make it really easy for you, what is the narrative that the West puts out of Islam? Is it what Islam is? You understand what I'm saying? Like the way that they draw or explain or paint a picture of Islam, is it what actually Islam is, or is it what they want it to be? Understand what I'm trying to say? So they don't actually explain Islam to their public or through their media of what Islam is. They're not objective of what Islam. They don't actually tell what the Prophet ﷺ did. They'll just choose pieces out of context that will suit their ability or allow them to say that it's not a good thing. That's a straw man fallacy. Make a weak, the straw man is basically, instead of fighting a real man, make a straw man that's weak. So you can punch him as many times and act like you beat him, right? Instead of actually fighting the guy who is probably stronger than you, you make a straw man out of straw so that you can punch him, he won't punch back because he's not the real thing. He's a bad duplicate of something that was much better than that, right? So, and I'll give you, this fallacy specifically will have like a couple of examples. So don't worry, you'll hear, like I'll give you very clear examples of that, inshallah ta'ala, yeah. Yeah. So that comes back to the same problem. So mechanistic way of thought, that's what they say, but that's not truthful. That's a fallacy in itself by saying that, no, if there's no materialistic proof, I'm not saying there's no proof, I'm saying there's no materialistic proof, then it's not true. That's not righteous, or it's not the truth. That is not correct. That is wrong. That's a fallacy in of itself, and that's why it's a problem today. Because people now have been worshiping at the tomb of science for so long that anything that science is not going to tell us, then we can't accept anymore. Forgetting that there's a lot more to life than just what science has offered us and who we are as human beings and what we experience in the world and how we see things and how we build perspectives and how we go by stuff. Science obviously offers a lot, and that's fine, but it cannot substitute philosophy. Philosophy has been bullied for the last maybe couple of centuries, been fully bullied, like down to the ground. One of the most important disciplines of science or disciplines of thought that exist for the human race was philosophy. It's really what allowed civilizations to become what they became. Thinkers only became, like, intelligence was built through philosophy. If you remove it altogether as a discipline, say it doesn't exist or it's not important anymore, which is what scientism is. There's science and there's scientism, which is different, which is basically denying any use or benefit of philosophy itself. So when they come and say that, no, if there's no physical proof, then it's not, then it could be wrong. Who told you that? That's not true. That was never true. That has never been true. That's not how we actually go by our lives. That's not how the legal system works. That's not how science works. That's not how science works. Like, even science doesn't work that way. Like, if science worked that way, by the way, you would only have maybe 10 drugs in the world. That's it. You have 10 drugs. And the rest, everything is not, there's no physical proof. We just have patterns. We just have evidence. Patterns is what I mean by evidence. You have something that's happening time and time again, pointing in the same direction, it seems. We give this, this happens. We give this, this happens. Does it have 50 times? Then now we're, you know, that's what evidence means, yeah. 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 And that's physical proof. And that's physical proof. They're saying if there's no physical proof, yeah, but you don't understand research then, because there's always a chance that this is a false negative or a false positive. There's always a chance, there's a 0.05 that this is a false positive. Every 20 studies, one of them is a false positive. That's following the 0.05 p-value. Out of 20 studies, one of them is a false positive. So maybe you're overestimating even what you're doing, Yanni, when it comes to physical proof. And I find that signs and evidence that are overwhelming, that do not lack any of the actual sources, is much more meaningful. Like, it means more. Because in physical proof, you'll have like 10 studies that say this is right, and then one that says that. We just ignore the one that says that. I'm telling you, out of all the sources of belief, if one of them says something different, forget about the whole thing. When I tell you about sources of belief and evidence, if one of them is saying this is not the right thing, this is not the most probable thing, this is not the most simple and clear explanation, forget about everything. We'll close up and leave, and we don't have to do this anymore. Physical proof doesn't even follow that. I come to patients all the time, and like, yeah, there's one study that said this worked, but there's like 10 that said it doesn't work, and I'm not going to go by that one study. We'll go by this. So it's a fallacy in of itself. It'll come up. That's why I didn't want to do these questions. It'll come up, Yanni, in 2 days or so when we talk about the theory of evolution, but we'll leave it until then, inshallah ta'ala. Any other final questions? Okay, جزاكم الله خير. سبحانك اللهم وبحمدك اشهد ان لا اله الا انت استغفرك واتوب اليك وصلى الله وسلم وبارك على نبينا محمد وعلى اله وصحبه اجمعين بارك الله فيكم جزاكم الله خير السلام عليكم ورحمه الله تعالى وبركاته